Satan, Ilium by Dan Simmons, continuing on page 290. Manmatha Moravec could care less what will the poet in the sonnets did to the young man, or expected done in return. Manmut had neither penis nor anus and longed for neither, but the copious flattery and flagrant bullying of the thick-witted but wealthy youth by the older poet was oppressive to Manmut now, bordering on the perverse. He skipped to the Dark Lady sonnets, but these were even more cynical and perverse. Manmut agreed with the analysis that the poet's interest in this woman was centered precisely on her promiscuity. This woman of the dark hair, dark eyes, dun breasts, and dark nipples was, if the poet was to be trusted, not a whore, but certainly something of a slut. Manmut had long since downloaded Freud's 1910 essay, A Special Type of Choice of Object Made by Men, in which the Lost Age witch doctor had documented cases of human males who could be sexually aroused only by women well known to be promiscuous. Shakespeare had no hesitation of describing a woman's vagina as the bay where all men ride, and sneeringly punning, "Oh, cunning love," about his dark lady's easy promiscuity, and Manmut had spent happy years finding deeper levels and dramatic structures behind these vulgarities. But this day, the sun close to setting straight down the great inland sea, the cliffs glowing rose-red to the north, he could see the sonnets only as dirty linen, a raunchy poet's private confessions.
"Reading your sonnets?" asked Orpu.
Manmut closed the book. "How'd you know? Have you taken up telepathy now that you've lost your eyes?"
"Not yet," rumbled the Ionian.
Orpu's great crab shell was lashed to the deck, 10 meters from where Manmut sat near the bow.
"Some of your silences are more literary than others, is all."
Manmut stood and turned toward the sunset. The little green men were hustling in the rigging and along the sea anchor hawser, readying the ship for their sleep. "Why'd they program some of us to have a predisposition for human books?" he asked. "What possible use is that to a Moravec now that the human race may be extinct?"
"I've wondered that myself," said Orpu. "Goras III and Repo were free from our affliction, but you must have known others who were obsessed with human literature."
"My old partner, Ertzwar, read and reread the King James version of the Bible," said Manmut. "He studied it for decades."
"Yes," said Orpu. "And me and my Proust."
He hummed a few bars of Me and My Shadow.
"Do you know what all these works we gravitate toward have in common, Manmut?"
Manmut thought about it for a moment. "No," he said at last.
"They're inexhaustible," said Orpu.
"Inexhaustible?"
"Incapable of being used up. If we were human, these particular plays and novels and poems would be like houses that always opened onto new rooms, hidden stairways, undiscovered attics. That sort of thing."
"Uh-huh," said Monmouth, not buying into this metaphor.
"You don't sound happy with the bard today," said Orpu.
"I think his inexhaustibility has exhausted me," admitted Manmut.
"What's happening on deck? A lot of activity?"
Manmut turned away from the sunset. 3/4 of the ship's complement of LGM were silently scurrying and tying down and clambering and letting out the sea anchor and securing. There were only 3 or 4 minutes of usable sunlight left before they went into hibernation, lying down, curling up, and shutting down for the night. "Did you feel the vibrations in the deck?" Manmut asked his friend. Except for smell, it was the last sense left to Orpu.
"No, I just knew it was that time of day," said the Ionian. "Why don't you help them?"
"Pardon me?"
"Help them," repeated Orpu. "You're an able-bodied seaman, or at least you know a hawser from a hacksaw. Give them a hand, or your nearest Moravec equivalent."
"I'd just get in the way." He looked at the quick work and perfect precision of the little green men. They scuttled out along the rigging and up the mast like videos he'd seen of monkeys. "We don't have telepathy," added Manmut, "but I'm pretty sure they do. They don't need my help."
"Nonsense," said Orpu. "Make yourself useful." I'm going back to reading about Monsieur Swan and his faithless girlfriend.
Monmouth hesitated a moment, but then slipped the irreplaceable book of sonnets into his backpack, trotted to the mid-deck, and joined in the lashing down of the lowered lateen sail. At first the LGM paused in their synchronized work and just stared at him, black button anthracite eyes staring from their clear, featureless green faces. But then they made room, and Monmouth, glancing at the setting sun and breathing in the clean Martian air, set to work with a will. Over the next few weeks, Monmouth's mood changed from depression to satisfaction, to something like the Moravec equivalent of joy. He worked every day with the LGM, keeping up his conversation with Orfu even as he sewed sails, spliced rigging, swabbed decks, pulled on the anchor, and took his turn at the tiller. The Felucca was making about 40 kilometers progress a day, which seemed like very little until one took into account that they were moving upstream, sailing with irregular winds, rowing much of the time, and stopping completely during the night. Since the Valles Marineris was about 4,000 kilometers long, almost the width of the Lost Age nation called the United States, Monmouth was resigned to making the transit in about 100 Martian days. Beyond the west edge of the Inland Sea, he kept reminding himself, and Orfu reminded him when he forgot, was more than 1,800 kilometers of Tharsis Plateau. Monmouth was in no hurry. The pleasures of the sailing ship, she had no name as far as the Moravec could tell, and he wasn't about to kill a little green man to ask, were simple and real. The scenery was astounding. The sun was warm in the day and the air deliciously cool at night, and the desperate urgency of their mission was fading under the reassuring cycle of routine. Near the end of the sixth week, on the water, Monmouth was working on the forward of the Felucca's two masts when a chariot appeared less than a kilometer dead ahead of the ship flying low, only 30 meters or so higher than the ship's sails, allowing Monmouth no time to scurry for cover. He was alone at the intersection of the two segments of mast. A Felucca's sails are triangular, its two masts segmented, the upper section slanted rakishly back, and no little green men were in the rigging. Monmouth was completely exposed to the gaze of anyone or anything flying the chariot. It passed over, traveling several hundred kilometers per hour, and so low that Monmouth could see that the two horses pulling the chariot were holograms. A man in a tan tunic was the only occupant, standing tall and holding the virtual reins. The figure was golden-skinned, powerfully handsome, with long blonde hair streaming behind him. He did not deign to look downward. Monmouth used the opportunity to study the vehicle and its occupant with every visual filter, frequency, and wavelength he had at his disposal, tight-beaming the data to Orfu in case the chariot god had seen him and decided to blast Monmouth off the mast with a wave of his hand. The horses, reins, and wheels were holographic, but the chariot was real enough, composed of titanium and gold. Monmouth couldn't detect any rocket, ion pulse or jet wake, but the chariot was putting out energy all across the EM spectrum. Enough to drown out Monmouth's radio narrative to Orfu if they hadn't been on tight beam. More ominously, the flying machine was trailing four-dimensional streamers of quantum flux. Part of the thing's energy profile was captured in a force field that Monmouth could clearly see in the infrared. A shield of energy forward of the hurtling aircraft to protect it from the wind of its own passage, and a broader defensive bubble all around. Monmouth was glad he hadn't thrown a rock at the chariot or shot at it, if he'd had a rock or energy weapon, which he did not. That force field, Orfu calculated, would keep the driver safe from anything short of a low-yield nuclear explosion.
"What's making it fly?" asked Orfu, as the chariot receded in the east. "Mars doesn't have enough of a magnetic field to propel any EM flying machine."
"I think it's the quantum flux," said Monmouth from his perch on the mast. It was a windy day, and the Felucca was rocking from side to side as it tacked back and forth, and the white caps batted at it from the south.
Orfu made an impolite sound. "Directed quantum distortion can rip time and space apart, people and planets, too. But I don't see how it can fly a chariot."
Monmouth shrugged despite the fact that his friend, invisible under the top rigged on the mid-deck, couldn't see him. "Well, it didn't have propellers," he said. "I'll download you the data, but it looked to me like the awkward thing was surfing on a curl of quantum distortion."
"Peculiar," said Orfu. "But even 1,000 such flying machines couldn't explain the locus of quantum distortion repo recorded on Olympus Mons."
"No," agreed Monmouth. "At least this god didn't see us." There was a pause in the conversation, and Monmouth listened to the crash of the Felucca's bow against the waves and the flap of the latine-rigged canvas as the big sails filled with wind again. There was a soft wind strum through the rigging up where Monmouth was, and he enjoyed the sound of it. He also enjoyed the less-than-gentle pitch and roll of the ship as it tacked, even while he compensated for it easily as he clung to the mast with one hand, his other hand on a taut line. They were deep into the widest section of the flooded rift valley now, in an area called Milas Chasma, with the huge, radiating sub-sea of Kanda Chasma opening up to the north, and the seabed more than 8 kilometers beneath them. But there were cliffs belonging to huge islands, some several hundred kilometers long and 30 or 40 kilometers across, visible on the horizon to the south.
"Perhaps he saw you and just radioed back to Olympus for reinforcements," suggested Orfu.
Monmouth sent the radio static equivalent of a sigh. "Always the optimist," he said.
"Realist," amended Orfu. But the tone of the next broadcast was serious. "You know, Monmouth, that you'll have to talk to the little green men again soon. We have too many questions that need answering."
"I know," said Monmouth. The thought made him vaguely ill in a way that the pitching and rolling of the Felucca never could.
"Perhaps we should inflate and launch the balloon sooner rather than later," Orfu suggested again.
Monmouth had spent several days cobbling together a wider, broader gondola from the bamboo 3 of the first one and some borrowed planks from one of the Felucca's less essential bulkheads. The LGM had not seemed to mind his borrowing their boards. "I still don't think we should launch yet," said Monmouth. "We're not even sure about the prevailing winds this month, and the pulse thrusters won't give us much steering once the balloon gets up into the Martian jet stream. We'd better get as close to Olympus as we can before we risk the balloon."
"I agree," said Orfu after a silence, "but it is time we talk to the LGM again. I have a theory that it's not telepathy that they're using, either when they communicate with you or pass information among themselves.
No?" said Monmouth, looking down at a dozen of the little green men as they came up from the ore decks and began working efficiently on the forward rigging. "I can't imagine what else it could be. They certainly don't have mouths or ears, and they're not transmitting data on any radio, tight beam, maser, or light frequency."
"I think the information is in the particles in their bodies," said Orfu. "Nanopackets of encoded information. That's why they insist you use your hand to grasp that internal organ. It's a sort of telegraph central. And your hand, as opposed to, say, your general manipulators, is organic. Living molecular machines can pass into your bloodstream via osmosis and travel to your organic brain, where the same nanobites help translate."
"Then how do they communicate among themselves?" asked Monmouth, dubious. He'd like the telepathy theory.
"The same way," said Orfu. "Touch. Their skins are semi-permeable, probably with data passing to and fro with every casual contact."
"I don't know," said Monmouth. "Remember how this crew seemed to know everything about us when the Felucca arrived? Where we were going? I had the feeling that our presence had been broadcast telepathically all along the little green man's psychic network."
"Yes, it appeared that way to me as well," said Orfu. "But besides the fact that neither human nor Moravec science has ever established even a theoretical framework for telepathy, Occam's razor would dictate that the Felucca crew learned of us through simple physical contact with the LGM at our landing site, or from others who had been there."
"Nanopackets of data in the bloodstream, eh?" said Monmouth, allowing the skepticism to be audible in his tone. But one of these individuals still has to die if I'm going to ask more questions.
Regrettably, said Orfu, not bringing up his earlier arguments that individual LGM probably had no more autonomous personality than did human skin cells. Several of the little men were clambering on the forward mast near Monmouth now, tying off lines and sliding down the lateen sail with the ease of acrobats. They nodded their green heads amicably as they passed on their way up or down. I think I'll wait until later to ask them, said Monmouth. There's a huge brown-red cloud on the southern horizon right now, and they'll need all hands to get the ship ready for the coming storm. 27. The Plains of Ilium. The Trojans are massacring the Greeks. My students in my other life would have said that they're decimating the Greeks, using that term for total destruction so loved by late 20th and early 21st century lazy journalists and illiterate TV anchor persons. But since to decimate was a precise term, the Romans killing every 10th man in a village in response to uprisings, and that would only result in 10% casualties, it's fair to say that they're doing much worse than decimating the Greeks. The Trojans are massacring the Greeks. After Zeus's ultimatum to the other gods, he QTs to Earth in his golden chariot and lands on the slopes of Mount Ida, the tallest mountain within easy god view of Ilium, and assumes his oversized throne on the mountaintop there, gazing down and out at the high walls of the city and the hundreds of Achaean warships on the beach and at anchor offshore. The other gods are too intimidated to come down to play after Zeus's demonstration of raw power, so the father of the gods holds out his golden scales and weighs the fates of death for the men below. One weight molded in the form of a Trojan horseman, the other an Argive spearman armored in bronze. Zeus raises high the sacred scales, holding the beam mid-haft, and down goes the Achaeans' day of doom, while the fortunes of Troy go lifting skyward. Zeus smiles at this, and I'm close enough to see that the old bastard had his thumb on the scales. The Trojans come broiling out of their city gates like hornets out of a disturbed hive. The sky is low, gray, seething with dark energy, and Zeus's thunderbolts strike the battlefield frequently, and always among the Argives and long-haired Achaeans. Clearly seeing the signs of the displeasure of the king of the gods, the Greeks still surge forward to fight. What else can they do? And the plains of Ilium echo to the crash of shields pounded hide to hide, the scrape of pike, the rumble of chariots, and the screams of dying men and horses. It goes badly for the Achaeans from the start. Lightning strikes among them, frying men like bronze-clad chickens on a rotisserie. Hector charges forward like a force of nature, and the quiet man I admired on the walls of Ilium with his wife and child is gone, replaced by a bloodied berserker, cutting men down like stalks of grass, and screaming to his followers for more blood, more carnage. His followers obey, the entire Trojan army and allies shouting as if from a single throat and surging forward en masse, rolling over the retreating Achaeans like a bronze and leathered tsunami. Paris, whom I dismissed as a fop in my description of his meeting with Hector only the day before and then proceeded to cuckold, rides near Hector and also comes on like some demon-possessed killing machine. Paris's killing expertise is archery, and on this day his long arrows never seem to miss. Achaeans and Argives drop with Paris's long shaft arrows in their throats, hearts, genitals, and eyes. Every shot is a hit. Hector slashes his way through every pocket of Greek resistance, hacking necks like daisy stems, offering no quarter and hearing no pleas for mercy in the deafness of his killing frenzy. When Achaeans manage to rally against the Trojan onslaught in a brave clump of resistance here or there, a bolt of blue energy from the roiling clouds explodes among them like a cosmic grenade, and the thunder that follows mixes with the cries of dying men. Idomeneus and the great king Agamemnon cut and run. Then big and little Ajax, campaigners of 1,000 battles, lose heart and flee the field. Odysseus, the long-enduring, can't endure this slaughter, and decides that the greater part of valor must reside in the safety of his ships back on the beach. It runs damned fast for a short-legged man.
The only man who doesn't turn and flee is old Nestor, and that's only because Helen's husband has put an arrow through the skull of Nestor's lead horse, tangling the other steeds in their panic. Nestor cuts the traces clear with his sword, obviously with every intent of vacating the battlefield as fast as he can. But Hector's chariot surges forward, the men around Nestor fall dead with Paris's arrows protruding from their chests and necks, and the horses flee even faster than the departed Greek heroes, leaving old Nestor standing in his horseless chariot with Hector fast approaching. When Odysseus sprints by, not even giving the old man a glance, Nestor cries, "Where are you going in such a hurry, son of Laertes? O cool tactician!" But his sarcasm is wasted. Odysseus disappears in the dust cloud of panicked retreat without slowing for his old friend. Diomedes, always more afraid of being called a coward than he is of pain or death, drives his chariot back into the fray, obviously intent on rescuing Nestor and driving back Hector. He swoops Nestor up like a wrinkled bag of laundry, and the old charioteer seizes the reins in both hands, driving Diomedes' chariot not away from the charging Hector, but toward him. Diomedes gets close enough to cast his spear at Hector, but the heavy shaft kills Hector's driver, Aniapeus, son of Thebeus. And for a moment, as the driver's corpse flies backward into the surprised foot soldiers, and Hector's horses rear out of control, everything changes. I've read that there is a moment like this in many battles, where everything hangs in the balance. As Hector fights to regain control of his horses and the Trojans with him pause in confusion, the Greeks see a possible reversal of fortune and rush into the gap, loping after old Nestor and Diomedes. For an instant, the Achaeans have the initiative again, shouting their defiance and hacking down the men leading the Trojan assault. Then Zeus intervenes again. Thunder booms, lightning splits the earth, and horses disappear in a flash of light and the stink of sulfur and burning hooves. Achaean chariots near Diomedes and Nestor explode in a tumble of horseflesh and flying bodies. Bronze melts, and leather shields burst into flame. It's obvious even to the thick-skulled Diomedes that Zeus is not pleased with him this day. Nestor tries to drag the rearing horses around, but they have the metaphorical bit in their very real mouths and can't be managed. Their chariot, all alone now since the other Achaeans have turned tail and fled, bounces toward 10,000 angry Trojans.
"Quick, Diomedes, grab the reins and help me swing these stallions around," cries Nestor. "To fight more today is to die today."
Diomedes grabs the reins from the old man but does not turn the chariot.
"Old soldier, if I run today, Hector will brag to his troops. Diomedes ran for his ships, and I drove him back."
Nestor grabs Diomedes by his muscled throat.
"What are you, 6 years old? Turn the fucking chariot, you asshole, or Hector will be wearing both our guts for garters before it's tea time in Troy."
Or some words to that effect. I am 100 yards across the battlefield when this occurs, and the shotgun mic on my baton might not be working correctly. Also, since I am morphed into the shape of a Trojan foot soldier, I'm running with the rest, watching all this over my shoulder as Paris's arrows fall around us and among us. Diomedes wrestles with his dilemma for 2 or 3 seconds, and then wrestles the horses instead, turning their heads, driving the chariot back toward the black ships and safety.
"Ha!" screams Hector over the din. He has a new driver, Archeptolemus, Iphitus' handsome son, and is coming on again with the renewed vigor of a man truly enjoying his work. "Ah, Diomedes! Made you run, you coward, you girly girl! You glittering little puppet, you quavering sparrow fart!"
Diomedes turns again in the chariot, glowering with fury and embarrassment, but Nestor has the reins now, and the horses themselves have figured out which way safety lies. The chariot rolls over boulders, ruts, and fleeing Greek foot soldiers in the horses' wild gallop toward the beach and safety. And the only way Diomedes can fight Hector now is by leaping off the chariot and fighting the thousands of Trojans on foot. He chooses not to do this. "If you want to change our fates, you must find the fulcrum," Helen had said that morning. She'd asked me then about my knowledge of the Iliad, although she thought of it as my oracle sense of the future, and pressed me to find the fulcrum of events, the single point in the 10-year war on which everything pivoted. Fate's hinge, as it were. I'd hemmed and hawed that morning, distracting her and myself with a final bout of lovemaking, but I'd thought about that question in the crazy hours since. If you want to change our fates, you must find the fulcrum. I'd bet my tenure as a Homerian scholar that the fulcrum of this particular tragic tale was fast approaching. The embassy to Achilles. So far, events continue, more or less, to follow the poem, even with Aphrodite and Ares sidelined by wounds. Zeus has laid down the law and intervened on the side of the Trojans. I have no intention of QTing back to Olympus unless I have to, but I can guess that Homer's narrative is being played out there as well. Queen Hera, fretting that her Argives are getting pummeled and trying to persuade Poseidon to intervene on their behalf, but the god who rocks the earth, being shocked by the suggestion, he has no desire to battle Zeus. Then when the Greeks are really routed later today, Athena will strip naked, then dress in her best battle armor and glistening breastplate. Well, I confess that it might be worth QTing to Olympus for that. But is stopped cold by Zeus's messenger Iris. Zeus's message will be succinct. If you and Hera come to oppose me by clash of arms, my gray-eyed girl, I'll maim your racers from beneath their yokes, hurl both you goddesses down from your chariot, smash your car, and rend both of you so terribly with my lightning bolts that you'll be in the healing vats 10 slow wheeling years before the green worms can stitch you together again. Athena will stay on Olympus. The Greeks, after a few hours of successful counterattack, will suffer heavier losses and fall back behind their own fortifications, a trench dug 10 years ago shortly after landing. 1,000 sharpened stakes, all the defenses recently deepened and built back up at Agamemnon's order. But even behind their own wall, the panicked Achaeans will lose hope and vote to sail for home. Agamemnon will try to rally them by throwing a great feast for his commanders, even as Hector and his thousands organize for the final charge that they know will end in the burning of the Achaeans' black ships and the settling of this war for once and all. And at the Greek king's feast, Nestor will argue that their only hope lies in Agamemnon making up with Achilles. Agamemnon will agree to pay Achilles a king's ransom. More than a king's ransom. 7 fire tripods, 10 bars of gold, 20 burnished cauldrons, 12 stallions, 7 beautiful women, and I can't remember what else. A partridge in a pear tree, perhaps. Most important, the bribe will include Briseus' daughter Briseis, the slave wench who was at the center of this whole argument. To wrap this gift in a red ribbon, Agamemnon will also swear that he's never bedded Briseis. As a final incentive, he also throws in 7 citadels, Greek kingdoms, Gaudamele, Inope, Hyre, Anthea, Thyre, Epeia, and Pedasus. Of course, Agamemnon doesn't own or rule these citadels. He's giving away his neighbor's lands, but I suppose it's the thought that counts. The one thing Agamemnon will not offer Achilles is his apology. The son of Atreus is still too proud to bow. Let him bow down to me, he'll shout at Nestor, Odysseus, Diomedes, and the other captains in a few hours. I am the greater king, I am the elder born, and, I claim, the greater man. Odysseus and the others will see a way out despite Agamemnon's arrogance. They realize that if they bring the message of Briseis' return and all these other marvelous gifts, and just happen to leave out the I'm the greater man bit, there's a chance that Achilles might rejoin the fight. At least this embassy to Achilles offers a ray of hope. But here the complicated part begins. Here the fulcrum may yet be found. As a scholar, I know in my soul that the embassy to Achilles is the heart and pivot of the Iliad. Achilles' decisions upon hearing the embassy's entreaties will determine the flow of all future events, the death of Hector, the subsequent death of Achilles, the fall of Ilium. But here's the tricky part. Homer chooses his language very carefully, perhaps more carefully than any other storyteller in history. He tells us that Nestor will name 5 men for the embassy to Achilles. Phoenix, Big Ajax, Odysseus, Odias, and Eurybates. The last two are mere heralds, decorations for the sake of protocol, and will not walk to Achilles' tent with the real ambassadors, nor take part in the discussion there. The problem here is that Phoenix is an odd choice. He hasn't appeared in the story before. He's more of a Myrmidon tutor and retainer to Achilles than a commander, and it makes little sense that he would be sent to persuade his master. To top that off, when the ambassadors are walking along the ocean's edge, where the battle line of breakers crash and drag, on their way to Achilles' tent, the verb form that Homer uses is a dual form. A Greek verb set between singular and plural, always relating to two people. In this case, Ajax and Odysseus. Homer uses seven other words that three. Where's Phoenix during this walk from Agamemnon's camp to Achilles' part of the encampment? Is he somehow already in Achilles' tent waiting for the embassy? That makes little sense. A lot of scholars before and during my time on Earth argued that Phoenix was a clumsy addition to the tale, a character added centuries later, which explains the dual verb form. But this theory ignores the fact that Phoenix will give the longest and most complex argument of the three ambassadors. His speech is so wonderfully digressive and complicated that it reeks of Homer. It's as if the blind poet himself had been confused about whether there were two or three emissaries to Achilles and what, exactly, Phoenix's role was in the conversation that would decide all the players' fates. I have a few hours to think about this. If you want to change our fates, you must find the fulcrum. But that's hours in my future. It's still mid-afternoon here, and the Trojans are pausing on the Ilium side of the Achaeans' moat, while the Greeks mill around like ants behind their wall of rocks and sharpened stakes. Still morphed as a sweaty Achaean spearman, I manage to get close to Agamemnon as the king first berates his men, and then pleads for Zeus's aid in their darkest hour. "Shame on all of you!" shouts the son of Atreus at his bedraggled army. Only 1/100 of the men can hear him, of course, ancient acoustics being what they are, but Agamemnon has a powerful voice, and those in the back pass the message on to others. "Shame! Disgrace! You dress like splendid warriors, but it's pure sham! You vowed to burn this city, and you gorged yourself on cattle, bought at my expense, and drank to the full those brimming bowls of wine, bought and shipped here at my expense. And now look at you, beaten rabble. You bragged that each of you could stand up to 100 Trojans, 200. And now you're no match for one mortal man, Hector. Any minute Hector will be here with his hordes, gutting our ships with blazing fire, and this vaunted army of heroes..." Agamemnon all but spits the word. "We'll be fleeing home to wife and kids. At my expense." Agamemnon gives up on the army and lifts his hands to the southern sky toward Mount Ida, from where the storms and thunder and lightning bolts have come. "Father Zeus, how can you tear away my glory so? How have I offended thee? Not once, I swear, not a single time have I passed a shrine of yours. Not even on our ocean voyage here, but did I stop and burn the fat and thighs of oxen to your glory? Our prayer was simple, to raise Ilium's walls to its roots, kill its heroes, rape its women, enslave its people. Is that too much to ask? Father, fulfill this prayer for me. Let my men escape with their lives, at least that. Don't let Hector and these Trojans beat us like rented mules." I've heard Agamemnon give more eloquent speeches. Hell, all of the speeches I've heard from him have been more eloquent than this, and I understand Homer's need to rewrite all this. But at that second, a miracle occurs, or at least the Achaeans take it as a miracle. Out of nowhere, an eagle appears flying from the south, a huge eagle carrying a fawn in its talons. The mob, who had been surging toward their ships and safety on the seas and who paused only briefly for Agamemnon's speech, freeze in place and point at the sight of this. The eagle soars, circles, dips lower, and drops the still-kicking fawn 100 feet to a sandy bump right at the base of the stone altar the Achaeans had raised to Zeus upon their landing so many years ago. That does it. After 15 seconds of stunned silence, a roar goes up from the men. Men beaten into cowardice 10 minutes earlier, but a fighting mob now, hearts and hands strengthened by this clear sign of forgiveness and approval from Zeus. And without further ado, 50,000 Achaeans and Argives and all the rest surge back into formation behind their captains. Horses are retethered to chariots. Chariots are driven out across the earth bridges still spanning the defensive trenches. And the battle is on again. It becomes the hour of the archer. Although Diomedes leads the counterattack, followed closely by the Atrides, Agamemnon, and Menelaus, followed in turn by Big Ajax and Little Ajax, and although these heroes take their toll on the Trojans in spear casts and short sword clashes, the fighting now is centered around the Achaean archer Teucer, bastard son of Telamon and half-brother to Big Ajax. Teucer has always been considered a master archer, and I've seen him shoot dozens of Trojans over the years, but this is his day in the limelight. He and Ajax get into a rhythm whereby Teucer crouches under the wall of his half-brother's shield. Big Ajax uses a giant rectangular shield that military historians say wasn't even in use during the time of the Trojan War. And when Ajax lifts the shield, Teucer fires from beneath it into the Trojan ranks some 60 yards away. On this day, he can't seem to miss his mark. First he kills Orsilochus, putting a barbed arrow in the short man's heart. Then he kills Ophelestes, putting a point through the captain's right eye when the Trojan peeks above his rawhide shield. Then Detor and Chromius fall mortally wounded from two fast, perfectly placed shots. Each time Teucer fires, the Trojans unleash their own arrows and spears in a vain attempt to kill the archer, but Big Ajax crouches over both of them, and his massive shield deflects every missile. The Trojan volleys pause, Ajax lifts his shield, and Teucer shoots Lycophontes, prince of his distant city, but just wounds the man. As Lycophontes' captains rush to his aid, Teucer puts a second arrow into the fallen man's liver. Polymnion's son, Amopaon, falls next, Teucer's shaft through his throat. Blood fountains 5 feet high, and the powerful Amopaon tries to rise, but the arrow has pinned him to the ground and he bleeds out in less than a minute, his body kicking and spasming ever more weakly. The Achaean's chair. I know, knew, Amopaon. The Trojan used to eat in the little open restaurant where Nightenhelser and I liked to meet. And we'd spoken many a time of trivial things. He told me once that his father, Polymnion, had known Odysseus in friendlier times, and once when traveling to Ithaca and joining the friendly Greeks on a hunt, Polymnion had killed a wild boar that had deeply gored Odysseus' leg and would have killed him if Polymnion's spear cast had missed its mark. Amopaon told me that Odysseus bears the scar to this day. Ajax crouches, holding his massive metal shield over him and his half-brother like a roof, and Trojan arrows rattle against it. Ajax rises, lifts the shield, and Teucer kills Melanippus, 80 yards away, with a shot that enters the man's groin and protrudes from his anus as the Trojan falls. His comrades step away and grimace as Melanippus writhes on the ground and dies. The Achaeans cheer again. Agamemnon swings down off his chariot and shouts encouragement at Teucer, promising the archer a second choice of tripods or purebred teams of horses. If Zeus and Athena ever allow him to plunder the treasure troves of Troy, he says. And then promises Teucer a beautiful Trojan woman to bed as well, perhaps Hector's wife Andromache. Teucer is angered by Agamemnon's offer. Son of Atreus, do you think I'll try any harder than I already am, spurred on by your talk of plunder? I'm firing as fast and accurately as I can. 8 arrows, 8 kills. Shoot at Hector, cries Agamemnon. I have been shooting at Hector, screams Teucer, his face red. All this time, Hector's been my target. I just can't hit the son of a bitch. Agamemnon falls silent. As if responding to the challenge, Hector suddenly urges his chariot to the front of the Trojan ranks, trying to rally his men who have lost heart because of the archer's slaughter. Ajax doesn't bother to lift his shield this time because Teucer stands, goes to full draw, takes careful aim at Hector, and lets fly. The shaft misses Hector's heart by a hand's breadth, striking Gorgothion as that son of Priam steps behind Hector's chariot. The big man stops, looks surprised, stares down at the protruding shaft and feathers as if he is the butt of some barracks joke, but then Gorgothion's head appears to become too heavy for his massive neck and falls limp to his shoulder as the weight of his helmet pulls it down. Then Gorgothion falls dead in the blood-muddied sand. "Damn," says Teucer, and fires again. Hector is the closest of all the Trojans now, turned full torso toward Teucer. This arrow catches Archetolemus, Hector's driver, full in the chest. The horses, war-trained as they are, rear and leap ahead as Archetolemus' blood geysers onto their flanks, and the young man pitches backward and off and into the dust.
"Sobrianes," cries Hector, grabbing the reins and calling to his brother, another bastard, son of profligate Priam, to be his driver. Sobrianes leaps up onto the chariot just as Hector jumps down. Enraged, beside himself with fury and grief at the death of his faithful Archetolemus, Hector runs into no man's land, a clear target for Teucer, and grabs the largest, sharpest rock he can lift in one hand. Hector seems to have forgotten all the finesse of warfare he's bragged about so many times, and has reverted to caveman tactics, lifting the rock and cocking his left arm far back, looking like nothing so much, I think, as Sandy Koufax preparing to unleash a pitch. I haven't noticed until today that Hector is ambidextrous. Teucer sees his chance, grabs another arrow from his quiver, and draws full back, aiming at Hector's heart. Sure, he can get off a shot, perhaps two, before Hector throws. He's wrong. Hector pitches hard, fast, flat, and accurately. The rock hits Teucer in the collarbone just beside the throat, an instant before the archer releases the arrow. Bones crack, tendons rip. Teucer's hand goes limp. The bowstring snaps, and the arrow buries itself in the ground between the archer's sandaled feet. Hector rushes forward, scattering Achaeans like chaff. And the Trojan archers fire arrow after arrow at the fallen Teucer. But big Ajax doesn't abandon his brother. He covers him with his wall of a shield while other Achaeans fight off the Trojan infantry. At Ajax's call, bellow really, Mecisteus and Alastor rush forward and carry the moaning, semi-conscious Achaean archer back across the trench bridge to relative safety in the shadow of the hollow ships. But Teucer's 15 minutes of fame are up. Things get worse for the Greeks very fast after this. Hector sees his survival as another sign of Zeus's love and approval and leads his men in charge after charge against the dispirited retreating Achaeans. Agamemnon, Menelaus, and the other lords who'd led their men into joyous combat just hours before are truly beaten now. The Achaeans are too routed at first even to man their defenses along the trench and stakes and makeshift wall. And the only thing that stops the Trojans from burning the ships right now is the setting sun and the sudden fall of darkness. While the Achaeans mill about in confusion, some of the men already readying their ships for departure, others sitting shell-shocked and vacant-eyed, Hector does his Henry V thing, roaming tirelessly up and down the Trojan ranks, urging his men on to more carnage come the dawn, sending men back to the city to herd cattle out for slaughter and sacrifice and feasting, ordering in rations of honeyed wine, calling up the wagons of fresh-baked bread that the ravenous Trojans attack as if it were Agamemnon himself, and giving the command to set hundreds of watchfires just beyond the Achaean defenses, so the fearful Greeks will get no sleep this night. I don my Hades helmet and walk invisible among the Trojans. "Tomorrow," cries Hector to his cheering men, "I'll gut Diomedes like a flopping fish in front of his men, if he doesn't choose to flee tonight. I'll break his spine with the tip of my spear, and we'll nail the braggart's head above the Scaean gates." The Trojans roar. The watchfires send sparks flying up toward the hard-burning stars. Invisible to gods and men,
I recross the trench bridge, wind my way through the sharpened stakes, and walk again amongst the dispirited Greeks. For me, it's time for truth or consequences. Agamemnon's already called the meeting of his captains, and they're arguing courses of immediate action. Flee, or send an embassy to Achilles. There's no turning back now. I morph into the form of Phoenix, Achilles' faithful Myrmidon tutor and friend, and walk across the cooling sand to join the council. If you're going to change our fates, you must find the fulcrum. 28. The Mediterranean Basin. Savi followed the Atlantic breach across the ocean, sometimes flying lower than the surface, hopping and dipping the Sony every few miles to avoid the connecting current cones that crisscrossed the breach like transparent pipes in a long green hallway. Lying prone to the left of Savi, seeing Harmon lying in his spot to her right, Demon was aware of the older man's grim expression and of the empty passenger slots behind them. Demon was thinking about the last 24 hours. Harmon and Ada had seemed at odds when they'd flown away from the big tree place. At first, that had pleased Demon. He didn't know what the falling out had been about, of course, but it had been obvious that both were agitated after their walk in the woods. Ada looking cool and distant, but inwardly seething. Harmon visibly confused. But after the hours of flying to Ardis and the events there, and Demon's decision to continue with this nonsense quest, the tension between Harmon and Ada seemed like just another thing to worry about. It had been late afternoon when they'd arrived at Ardis. The estate and grounds looked different from the air, at least to Demon, although the layout of the hills and forest and meadows and river were just as he remembered. Whenever he thought of their picnic down to the river, to Hannah's silly metal-pouring exhibition, he thought of the attacking dinosaur and his heart began to pound. "This area used to be called Ohio in the last part of the Lost Age," said Savi, as they circled and then flew lower. "I think." "I thought it was called North America," said Harmon. "That too," said the old woman. "They had a surplus of names for places." They landed about a quarter of a mile from Ardis Hall in a pasture north of a line of screening trees. Demon still had to use the toilet, but he was damned if he'd walk all that way to the estate if there was any chance of dinosaurs being in the area. "It's safe," Ada said brusquely, when she saw him hesitate, the only one still lying on the Sony. "The Voynix patrol a perimeter within 2 or 3 miles of the hall." "How far from the house was Hannah's hot metal picnic?" asked Demon. 3.5 miles, said Hannah. The young woman was standing near Odysseus behind the Sony. Ada turned to Savi. "Are you sure you won't come up to the house?" "I can't," said the old woman. She extended her hand, and after a second, Ada took it. Demon had never seen women shake hands before. "I'll wait here for Harmon and Demon to return," said Savi. Ada looked at Harmon. "You're coming up to Ardis for a minute, aren't you?" "Just to say goodbye." The two held their intense gaze. "Can we just go?" said Demon, hearing the whine in his own voice. He didn't care, he had to go. Everyone except Savi had started walking toward the distant house then, through the field of waist-high grass, past the occasional head of cattle. Demon gave each of the cows a wide berth since he wasn't comfortable around large animals, when suddenly a lone Voynix stepped out of the tree line ahead of them. "It's about time," said Demon. "This walking is ridiculous." He gestured to the iron and leather form. "You, go back to the hall and bring back 2 large carrioles to transport us there." Incredibly, the Voynix ignored Demon and kept walking toward the 5 humans, or to be more precise, toward Odysseus. The old bearded man pushed Hannah away from him as the eyeless Voynix slowly approached. "It's just curious," said Ada, although her voice lacked conviction. "It's probably never..." The Voynix was 5 feet from Odysseus when the man swept his sword from his belt, activated the humming blade with his thumb, and swung the sword with both hands, slicing down and across the Voynix's presumably impenetrable chest, shell, and left arm. For a second, the Voynix just stood there, apparently as shocked at Odysseus' behavior as the 4 humans were. But then the top half of the creature's body slid, tilted, and fell to the ground, arms spasming. The lower half of the Voynich's torso and its legs continued standing for several more seconds before tumbling over into the grass. For a minute, there was no sound.
"How in the hell did you do that?"
Blue fluid, as thick as blood, was everywhere. Odysseus pointed at the Voynich's right arm, still attached to the lower torso. As he wiped his sword on the grass, he said, "It had its killing blades extended." It was true. As the four gathered around the fallen Voynich, each could see the blades used for defending humans against such threats as dinosaurs, extended where the manipulator pads usually were.
"I don't understand," said Ada.
"It didn't recognize you," said Hannah, taking another step away from the bearded man. "Maybe it thought you were a threat to us."
"No," said Odysseus, sliding his short sword back into its scabbard.
Demon was staring with appalled fascination at the cross-section of the Voynich. Soft white organs, a profusion of blue tubules, clusters of what looked to be pink grapes, certainly not the clockwork mechanism and gears he'd always imagined to be the interior of a service Voynich. The speed of the violence and now the white gore visible had almost made Demon lose control of his anxious bowels.
"Come on," he'd said,
and started walking quickly toward Ardis Hall. The others had mistaken this for leadership and followed. It was after Demon had used the toilet, taken time to shower, shaved, ordered the nearest Ardis servitor to fetch him clean new clothes, and then wandered into the kitchen hunting for something to eat, that he realized that it was insane to go any further with Harmon and the crazy old woman. To what purpose? Ardis Hall, despite Ada's absence, or perhaps because of it, had filled with friends faxed in to visit and party. The servitors kept them happy with food and drink. Young people, including several beautiful young women Demon knew from other parties, other places, from his happy life before Harmon and all this nonsense, were playing lawn ball and hoop games on the broad sloping lawn. The evening was lovely, shadows long on the grass, laughter in the air like the sound of chimes, and dinner being prepared by servitors at the long table under the giant elm tree. Demon realized that he could stay here and have a proper meal and a good night's sleep, or, better yet, summon a Voynich for the short carryall ride to the fax portal, and sleep in his own bed in Paris Crater this night after a late dinner prepared by his mother. Demon missed his mother. He'd been completely out of touch with her for more than 2 days. He looked at the Voynich in the curved driveway at the side of the large house and felt a pang of anxiety. Odysseus' destruction of that Voynich had been unwarranted and insane. One didn't damage or destroy Voynichs any more than one would set fire to a droshky or trash one's own dummy. It didn't make any sense, and it was another reason he should get away from these people at once. As he came out onto the drive, he saw Harmon and Ada speaking softly but urgently to one side. Farther down the hilly lawn, he could see Hannah introducing Odysseus to several curious guests. The Voynichs were staying far away from the bearded man, but Demon had no idea whether that was by coincidence or design. Did Voynichs communicate with one another, and if so, how? Demon had never heard one utter a sound. He gestured to a Voynich to bring a carryall around just as Ada and Harmon's conversation came to an end. Ada stalking into the house, Harmon turning on his heel and heading back across the drive toward the fields and the waiting Sony. Harmon walked up to Demon, and the older man's expression was so grim that Demon took a half step back.
"Are you coming with us?"
No, stammered Demon. The Voynich trotted up with the single-wheeled carryall behind it, upholstery gleaming in the evening light, gyroscopes humming. Harmon turned without saying another word and walked off into the field behind the house. Demon climbed into the conveyance, said fax portal to the Voynich, and sat back as the carryall hummed around the driveway, white shells crunching under the wheel. One of the young women on the lawn, Ileo, he thought her name was, cried a goodbye to him. The carryall rolled down toward the road with the silent Voynich trotting between its stays.
"Stop," said Demon.
The Voynich halted in its tracks, still holding the cart shafts. The internal gyro hummed softly to itself. Demon looked back behind Ardis Hall, but Harmon was already out of sight through the trees. For no reason in particular, he tried to remember where he had met Ileo at a party in Bellinbot 2 summers ago. At Verna's 420 in Trom, only a few months before? At one of his own sleepover parties in Paris Crater? He couldn't remember. Had he slept with Elia? He had an image of the girl naked, but that could have been from one of the swimming parties, or one of the living art displays that had been in vogue last winter. He couldn't remember if he'd gone to bed with the woman. There were so many. Demon tried to remember Toby's second 20 celebration in Ulaanbaatar only 3 days ago. It was a blur, a smear of laughter and sex and drink, blending into all the other parties near all the other fax nodes. But when he tried to remember the dry valley in, what was it called, Antarctica, or the iceberg or the Golden Gate Bridge above Machu Picchu, or even the stupid redwood forest, everything was clear, distinct, sharp. Demon climbed down from the carryall and began walking toward the fields. This is crazy, he thought. Crazy, crazy, crazy. Halfway to the tree line, he broke into a lumbering, clumsy run. He was out of breath and sweating heavily by the time he reached the far side of the field. The sunny was gone, only a depression in the high grass near a stone wall where it had been.
God damn it, said Demon, looking up at the evening sky, empty except for the turning equatorial ring and polar ring.
Damn it! He sat down heavily on the moss-slick stone wall. The sun was setting behind him. For some reason, he felt like crying. The sony came in low over the trees to the north, swooped and hovered 10 feet off the ground. I thought you might change your mind, called down Savvy. Want a ride? Demon stood. They had flown east into darkness, climbing high enough that the stars and the orbital rings illuminated the tops of clouds, already glowing from lightning rippling like visible peristalsis through milky interiors. They stopped near the coast that night and slept in a strange treehouse made up of separate little dummy houses connected by platforms and winding staircases. The place had plumbing, but no servitors or voynichs, and there were no other people or dwellings nearby.
Do you have many places like this where you stay? Harmon asked Savvy.
Yes, said the old woman. Away from your 300 fax nodes, most of the earth is empty, you know. At least empty of people. I have favorite places here and there. They were sitting outside on a sort of dining platform halfway up the tall tree. Below them, fireflies winked on and off in a grassy glade that held an array of huge, ancient, rusted machines that had been mostly reclaimed by the grass and ferns and hillside. Ring light fell down between the leaves and painted the high grass a soft white. The storms they'd flown over had not reached this far east yet, and the night was warm and clear. Although there were no servitors here, there were freezers with food, and Savvy had supervised the cooking of noodles, meat, and fish. Demon was almost getting used to this odd idea of fixing the food one ate. Suddenly, Harmon asked Savvy, "Do you know why the post-humans left the Earth and haven't come back?" Demon remembered the strange data vision he'd suffered in the redwood clearing earlier that day. Just the memory made him a bit nauseated.
Yes, said Savvy, I think I do.
Are you going to tell us? Asked Harmon.
Not right now, said the old woman.
She rose and walked up the winding stairs to a lighted dummy 10 meters higher up the trunk. Harmon and Demon looked at each other in the soft light, but they had nothing to say to each other and eventually went off to their own dummies to sleep. They followed the breach across the Atlantic at high speed, swooped south before reaching land, and paralleled something that Savvy called the Hands of Hercules.
Amazing, said Harmon, rising almost to his knees to look to their left as they flew south.
Demon had to agree. Between a big slab-sided mountain on the north, which Savvy called Gibraltar, and a lower mountain some 9 miles to the south, the ocean simply stopped, held out of the deep basin, stretching away to the east by a series of huge, golden human hands rising from the seabed. Each hand was over 500 feet tall, and the splayed fingers held back the wall of the Atlantic from the dry Mediterranean basin, dropping like a deepening valley into clouds and fogs to the east.
Why the hands? Asked Demon as they reached land on the south side of the fog-shrouded basin and turned east again.
Why didn't the post-humans just use force fields to hold back the sea the way they did in the breach?
The old woman shook her head. The hands of Hercules were here before I was born, and the posts never told us why they did it that way. I've always suspected it was just a whim on their part.
A whim, repeated Harmon. It seemed to trouble him.
Are you sure we can't just fly straight across the basin? Asked Demon.
I'm sure, said Savi. Bassani would drop out of the sky like a stone.
Through the late afternoon, they flew across swamps, lakes, fern forests, and broad rivers above a land that Savi called the Northern Sahara. Soon the swamps dwindled and died, and the land became drier, rockier. Herds of huge striped beasts, not dinosaurs, but as large as dinosaurs, moved by the hundreds across grasslands and rocky uplands.
What are those? Asked Demon. Savi shook her head. I have no idea.
If Odysseus were here, he'd probably want to kill one and have it for dinner, said Harmon.
Savi grunted.
It was late afternoon again when they lost altitude, circled a strange walled city set on highlands only 25 miles from the Mediterranean basin, and landed on a rocky plain just west of the city.
What is this place? Asked Demon.
They'd never seen walls or buildings so old, and even from a distance it was unsettling.
It's called Jerusalem, said Savi.
I thought we were going down into the basin to look for spaceships, said Harmon.
The old woman got out of the Sony and stretched. She looked very tired, but then Demon thought she had been driving the Sony for 2 straight days.
We are, she said. We'll get transport here. And there's something I want you to see at sunset.
This sounded ominous to Demon, but he followed her and Harmon across the rocky plain, over rubble of what once might have been suburbs or newer sections of the old walled city, but which now was a rising plain paved with stones pounded and ground fine as pebbles. She led them up to and through a gate in the wall, keeping up a mostly meaningless narration as they walked. The air was dry and cooling, the low sunlight rich on the ancient buildings.
This was called the Jaffa Gate, she said, as if that might mean something to them. This is David Street, and it used to separate the Christian quarter from the Armenian quarter.
Harmon glanced at Demon. It was obvious to Demon that even the learned old man, so proud of his useless ability to read, had never heard the words Christian or Armenian. But Savi was babbling on, pointing out something called the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in the tumbled ruins to their left. And neither man interrupted her with a question until Demon asked,
Aren't there any Voynichs or servitors here?
Not now, said Savi, but when my friends Pincus and Petra were here in the last minutes before the final facts 1400 years ago, there were tens of thousands of Voynichs suddenly active near the western wall. I have no idea why. She stopped walking and looked at each of them. You understand, don't you, that the Voynichs popped out of the temporal clastic cloud 2 centuries before the final facts? But they were immobile, rust and iron statues, not the obedient servants you have now. That's important to remember.
All right, said Harmon, but his voice carried a hint of being patronizing. She was babbling. But you said you were in an iceberg down near Antarctica when the final facts came, continued Harmon. How do you know where your friends were and what the Voynichs were doing?
Farnet, Proxnet, and Allnet records, said the old woman.
She turned and led them further east down the street.
Harmon glanced at Demon again as if to share his concern about her nonsense talk, but Demon felt a rush of something, pride, superiority, as he realized that he knew exactly what she meant when she talked about Farnet and Proxnet. He looked at his own palm and keyed the finder function, but the glow was blank. What would happen, he wondered, if he visualized the 4 blue rectangles above 3 red circles, above 4 green triangles, to summon the full data function the way she'd taught him in the Forest Glen yesterday.
Savi stopped and spoke as if she'd read his mind. You don't want to invoke the Allnet function here, Demon. You wouldn't be virtually immersed in energy microclimate interactions like you were in the forest.
Not here in Jerusalem. You'd be dealing with 5,000 years of pain, terror, and virulent anti-Semitism.
Anti-Semitism? Repeated Harmon.
Hatred of Jews, said Savi.
Harmon and Demon looked at each other with quizzical expressions. The idea made no sense. Demon was beginning to be sorry that he'd changed his mind and come along. He was hungry. The sun was setting behind them. He didn't know where he was going to sleep this night, but he suspected that it would be uncomfortable. "Come," said Savi, and led them another block through stone doorways, down a narrow alley, and out into a space dominated by a tall blank wall. "Is this what we came to see?" said Demon, disappointed. It was a dead end, a courtyard bound around by lower walls, stone buildings, and this one big wall with some sort of round metallic structure just visible atop it. There was no way to get up there from here. "Patience," said Savi. She squinted at the disappearing sun. "And today's Tisha B'Av, just as it was on the day of the final fax." Looking as if he was tired of repeating nonsense syllables, Harmon said, "Tisha B'Av." "The 9th of Av," said Savi, "a day of lamentation. Both the first and second temples were destroyed on Tisha B'Av, and I think the Voyniks built this blasphemous third temple on the 9th of Av on the day of the final fax." She pointed to the black metal half-dome beyond the wall. Suddenly there was a rumble so deep that Demon's bones and teeth rattled. Both he and Harmon took a frightened step back, the air filled with ozone and static so thick that the hair on Demon's head rose and rippled like tall grass in a high wind, and with an explosive crash faster and louder than a lightning strike, a solid shaft of pure, brilliant light some 60 feet across shot up from the metal half-dome, pierced the evening sky, and disappeared arrow straight into space, barely missing the orbital E-ring in its eternal rotation to the east. 29. Kandar Kazma. For 8 Martian days and 8 Martian nights, the dust storm raised waves 10 meters high, howled through the rigging and pounded the little felucca northward toward the leeward shore and death for all hands, including the 2 Moraveks. The little green men aboard were competent sailors, but they ceased to function at night, and now were inert much of the day when the dust clouds overhead blotted out the sun. To Monmouth, when the LGM found their dark corners beneath decks and curled up in niches to keep from rolling around, it was like sailing in a ship of the dead, like Bram Stoker's Dracula, where the ship arrives crewed only by corpses. The Felucca's sails were made of a tough, lightweight polymer rather than canvas, but the ferocity of the wind out of the southeast and the particles and pebbles being blasted at them tore the sheets to shreds. The deck was no longer a safe place to be, and during a brief interval of sunlight, 20 LGM helped Monmouth cut a hole in the mid-deck and lower Orfu to the deck below, where Monmouth constructed a wooden tarp shelter for the Ionian and tucked him away from the pelting wind. Monmouth himself sensed the airborne grit getting into his seams and works when he spent too much time helping the LGM above decks, so he hunkered down on the lower deck near Orfu when he could, making sure his friend was roped and bolted into place as the Felucca pitched 40 degrees to each side and the water, now mixed with the blowing red sand and as red as blood, forced its way through every crack. A dozen of the 40 little green men aboard manned hand pumps every hour they were conscious, pumping out the bilge and lower decks, and Monmouth worked alone on a pump through the long nights. They had used the wind to good advantage before the sails, rigging, and sea anchor were all damaged, working hard, tacking hard, sailing into the wind, waves crashing over the bow to get deeper into the central inland sea. Obviously all worried about the kilometer-high cliffs behind them to the north, and covering hundreds of kilometers in the first 2 days of the storm. They were somewhere now between Copratis Kazma and the islands of Milas Kazma, with the huge flooded canyon complex of Kandar Kazma ahead somewhere on their starboard side. Then the storms grew worse, the skies grew darker, the LGM tucked and tied themselves into secure places below decks while they shut down in the sandstorm gloom. On both the bow and stern sea anchors, 2 elaborate curves of polycanvas dragging on cable, trailing hundreds of meters beneath the ship, gave way on the same day. Monmouth knew from earlier sightings that there were kilometer-high cliffs to their north and somewhere the broad opening to the flooded canyons of Kandar Kazma. But the electrostatic charge in the dust storm was defeating his GPS receiver, and it had been 2 days since he'd had a decent star or sunlight.
The cliffs and their doom might be a half hour away, for all he knew.
Is there a chance we might sink? Asked Orfu that afternoon of the fourth day.
The odds are good, said Monmouth. He didn't want to lie to his friend, so he tried to couch the phrase as ambiguously as he could.
Can you swim in this storm? Asked Orfu.
He'd understood that the good odds in that sentence was bad news for the both of them. Not really, said Monmouth, but I can swim under the waves.
I'll sink like the proverbial rock, said Orfu with a soft rumble. How deep did you say Valles Marineris was here?
I didn't say, said Monmouth.
Well, say now.
About 7 kilometers deep, said Monmouth, who had echoes sounded it just an hour earlier.
Would you crush at that depth? Asked Orfu.
No, I've worked at much deeper pressures. I'm designed for it.
Would I crush?
I don't know, said Monmouth. In truth, he did not, but he knew that Orfu's Moravec line had been designed for the zero pressure of space and for the occasional forays into the upper reaches of a gas giant or the sulfur pits of Io, not for the punishing pressures of a saline sea 7,000 meters deep. Most likely, his friend would be crushed to the size of a crumpled can or simply implode long before he reached 3 kilometers of depth.
Is there any chance of putting ashore? Asked Orfu.
I don't think so, said Monmouth. The cliffs I saw were enormous, sheer, with giant boulders at their base. Waves must be crashing 50 or 100 meters high there now.
An interesting image, said Orfu. Is there any chance of the LGM bringing us to safe harbor?
Monmouth looked around at the gloomy space on the lower decks. The LGM were tucked away and lashed to the decks like so many chlorophyll dolls, green arms and legs flopping with the wild pitching and rolling of the ship. I don't know, he said, and let his tone convey his skepticism.
Then you'll just have to get us through this, said Orfu.
Monmouth did his damnedest to save them. On the fifth day, with the sky a bloody darkness and the wind howling through the tattered sails, the LGM stowed like cordwood below, and the double wheel on the rear deck tied to hold the rudders straight. Monmouth lowered what was left of the sails and brought out the cord and huge needles he'd seen the LGM use to mend the polycanvas. Only now, he was sewing while the ship was lurching to and fro, 15-meter waves striking its side on, slewing the Falaka around, waves washing over the mid-deck. He rigged a smaller makeshift sea anchor first, deploying it from the bow anchor cable to bring the bow into the wind again, trying to beat away from the unseen but ever-present lee shore behind them. He'd started work mending the triangular mainsail when the rudder cables below deck snapped. The Falaka staggered, shipped several huge waves of red water, tore away its weather helm, and then slewed around and ran before the wind again, tall waves crashing over the rear deck. Only the crude sea anchor had kept them from capsizing when the rudder went. Monmouth went to the bow, and there, as the red clouds parted for just a moment, and as the Falaka rose to the top of the next wind-driven wave, he could see the high cliffs of the north side of Valles Marineris, visible through the spume and gloom. The ship would be on the rocks in less than an hour if the steering wasn't fixed, and fixed soon. Monmouth rigged a rope and went down over the stern to make sure that the rudder was still physically attached. It was, but swinging free on its massive gimbal. And then he climbed the wet rope through crashing waves, crossed the mid-deck, slid down stairways to the second deck, found the emergency steering center there, just a platform with pulleys where the LGM could steer the ship by physically pulling on the tiller ropes if the steering mechanism was damaged above. Found the two large cables there slack, scrambled down another ladder to the darkness of the third deck, flicked on his chest and shoulder lamps to illuminate his way, exchanged his manipulatives for cutting edges, and hacked through the deck to where he guessed the tiller ropes had parted. The Moravec had no idea if this was the way the ancient Earth Falakas had been rigged. He guessed not, but this large Martian Falaka was steered by a double wheel on the high stern deck, which turned two massive hemp ropes that parted ways, ran along each side of the ship through a system of pulleys, and then came together again to run through this long wooden shaft to the physical tiller that turned the rudder.
During the weeks of voyage, he'd wandered the ship learning the rigging and the layout of the various cable systems. If one or both of the great cables had simply parted, unthreaded by the stress of the storm, he might be able to splice them. But he had to be able to reach them. If they'd snapped farther back toward the tiller where he couldn't reach them, everyone aboard the ship was doomed. Would he jump at the last moment, try to swim beneath the crashing surf past the high cliffs, searching for a calm harbor somewhere along the 1,000 kilometers of shoreline of Kander Kazma from which to drag himself from the sea? One thing was certain, he couldn't bring Orfu of Io with him. Breaking through into the tiller rope shaft, he switched his beams to bright and looked fore and aft. He couldn't see the cables.
"Everything going all right?" asked Orfu.
Monmouth jumped at the sound of the radio voice in his ears.
"Yes," he said.
"Doing a little rudder repairs."
There they were.
The twin cables had snapped. The aft segments were about 6 meters away in the narrow guide box, the forward segments just visible 10 meters forward. He ran back and forth, smashing through the hardwood planking and pulling each section of thigh-thick cable out of its box and dragging them toward the center, using every erg of energy in his system.
"You sure everything's all right?" asked Orfu.
He retracted his cutting edges and extended all his manipulatives, setting his fine motor control to extra fine. He began splicing the strands of thick hemp so rapidly that his metallic fingers became a blur in the shafts of his halogen lights, cutting through the third deck darkness. Water sloshed back and forth past him and over him as the ship rolled backward up each terrible wave, and then slid down the wave's rear side, slewing into the trough. Then Monmouth would brace himself for the next wave crashing into the stern again with the sound and impact of a cannon being fired. And he knew that every wave meant the ship was that much closer to the waiting rocks and cliffs. "Everything's good," said Monmouth, fingers flying, weaving strands, using the low-wattage lasers at his wrist to spot-weld the metallic fibers that ran through the ragged hemp. "I'm busy right now."
"I'll check back in a few minutes," suggested Orfu.
"Yes," said Monmouth, thinking. "If I can't regain the steerage, we'll be on the rocks in 30 minutes or so. I'll tell him 15 minutes before the fact."
"Yes," answered Monmouth. "Do that. Check back in a few minutes."
She wasn't the Dark Lady. The crude Felucca had no name, but she was sailable and steerable again. Up on the rear deck, his legs and feet braced against the pitch and roll, the storm-lashed cliffs clearly visible less than a kilometer dead ahead, the tatters of canvas he'd sewn into crude sails raised on both masts, Monmouth grabbed the wheel. The tiller cable held and the rudder responded. He wrestled the ship around into the wind and called Orfu to inform him of the situation. He told the Ionian the truth. They probably had less than 15 minutes before the ship would be dashed on those rocks, but he was sailing this pig of a ship for all she was worth.
"Well, I appreciate your honesty," said Orfu. "Is there anything that I can do to help?"
Monmouth, leaning all his weight on the large wheel, turning the ship up the coming wave so as not to capsize her, said, "Any suggestions would be appreciated." The dust cloud showed no signs of lifting, nor the wind of abating. Lines hummed. Torn poly canvas flapped, and the bow disappeared in a wall of white foam that struck Monmouth 20 meters back. Orfu said,
"Yet again, what do you hear? Shall we give oar and drown? Have you a mind to sink?"
It took Monmouth a few seconds to place this. Riding over the next wave in near zero-G, looking back over his shoulder and seeing the 1,000-meter cliffs closer, the Moravec brought up the tempest in his secondary memory and cried,
"A pox on your throat, you bawling, blasphemous, incharitable dog!
Work you, then!"
"Hang, Kerr, hang, you hoarse and insolent noisemaker," said Monmouth, shouting over the wind and crash of wave, even though the radio comm needed no shouts to carry. "We are less afraid to be drowned than thou art."
"I'll warrant him for drowning," rumbled Orfu. "Though the ship were no stronger than a nutshell and as leaky as an unstanched wench."
"Monmouth, what exactly is an unstanched wench?"
"A menstruating woman," said Monmouth, fighting the wheel to port now, leaning into it. Tons of water washed across him. He could no longer see the cliffs over his shoulder because of the swirling red mist and higher waves, but he could feel the rocks behind him.
Oh,
said Orpheus, how embarrassing. Where was I? Lay her a hold, prompted Monmouth.
Lay her a hold, a hold. Set her two courses. Off to sea again, lay her off.
All lost, recited Monmouth. To prayers, all lost. Wait a minute.
I don't remember. Wait a minute, said Orpheus.
No, wait a minute. There's a break in the cliffs ahead, an opening in the coastline.
Big enough to sail into? Asked Orpheus.
If it's the opening to Kanda Kazma, said Monmouth, it's a body of water bigger than Connemara Chaos on Europa.
I don't remember how large Connemara Chaos was, admitted Orpheus.
Larger than all three of the North American Great Lakes, with Hudson Bay thrown in, said Monmouth. Kander Kazma is essentially another huge inland sea opening to the north. There should be thousands of square kilometers in which to maneuver. No lee shore.
Is that good?
Asked Orpheus, obviously unwilling to get his hopes up. It's a chance for survival, said Monmouth, pulling on lines to fill what was left of the mainsail with wind. He waited until they'd crested the next wave and swung the wheel, turning the heavy ship ponderously to starboard, swinging the bow toward that ever-widening gap in the coastal cliffs. It's a chance for survival, he said again. It ended on the afternoon of the eighth day. 1 hour, the dust clouds were still low and scudding, the wind was still raging, and the seas within the great Kander Kazma basin remained white and wild. The next hour, after a final bloody rain, the skies were blue, the seas grew placid, and the little green men stirred from their niches and came up on deck like children rising from a restful nap. Monmouth was spent. Even with a recharge trickle from the portable solar cells and occasional jolts from their draining energy cubes, he was worn out organically, mentally, cybernetically, and emotionally. The LGM seemed to marvel at what remained of the mended sails, of the spliced tiller cables, and at other repairs Monmouth had carried out in the past 3 days. Then they got to work, crewing the bilge pumps, hosing down the blood-red decks, mending more canvas, caulking the warped hull and bulkhead planks, repairing splintered masts, untangling lines, and sailing the ship. Monmouth went to the mid-deck and supervised the lifting of Orpheus from the soggy lower deck, helped secure his friend to the deck and rigged the sun tarp over him, and then Monmouth found a warm, sunny place on the mid-deck, out of the way, with a wooden wall behind him and a coil of rope in front ameliorating the agoraphobia a bit. And there, he allowed himself to float into a half-stupor. When he shut down his eyes, he could still see the high waves approaching, feel the pitching deck beneath, and hear the howl of wind despite the calm seas around them now. He peeked. The ship was sailing south again, tacking into the mild southwestern wind, heading back toward the broad opening where Kander Kazma opened into the Valles Marineris, at the place called Milis Kazma. Monmouth shut down his vision again and allowed himself to doze off. Something touched Monmouth's shoulder, and he started awake. One by one, the 40 LGM were filing past him, each green figure touching him on the shoulder as it passed. He reported this to Orpheus, using the subvocal channel. End of side 10.